on it.
KSDP, 830 AM, Sandpoint, K201DA, King Cove, KFPS, False Pass.
I don't see things going in a positive direction. I really don't. The cost of living has already been elevated for a while.
New economic surveys show that consumers are worried about inflation and the job market. What does that mean for the economy?
For Friday, March 28th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The Trump administration is intensifying its efforts to end diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts, not just in the government, but also in the private sector.
The Labor Department is now scrutinizing federal contractors.
Overwhelming majority of these practices are fully lawful.
Also this hour, a look at how Elon Musk's Starlink satellite network could soon have more power over how underserved parts of the country get online.
If the decision is made on the basis of politics, it will cost the country for decades to come.
Those stories and more coming up after these news headlines.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Secretary of State Marco Rubio has notified Congress that he's bringing what's left of the U.S. Agency for International Development under the State Department. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports the Trump administration has also notified USAID staff that most jobs will be eliminated.
Secretary Rubio says he believes the country's lead aid agency strayed from its mission, and he says, in his words, this misguided and fiscally irresponsible era is now over. Hundreds of USAID employees are being laid off. Spokesperson Tammy Bruce says with every big change, there will be disruptions.
From Secretary Rubio down, we are committed to ensuring that USAID personnel remain safe and that the agency's ongoing life-saving aid programs remain both intact and operational.
She would not say how much it will cost to repatriate USAID employees now serving around the world, or say whether local staff at embassies would be fired. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
A federal judge in Boston has blocked the Trump administration from quickly deporting migrants to a third country other than the one they have a relationship with. NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran has more.
The nationwide temporary restraining order was issued by U.S. District Judge Brian Murphy. His order blocks the Trump administration from immediately removing any migrant to a country other than the ones they were born in or are citizens of. Per the order, the Trump administration must give anyone with a final order of deportation a, quote, meaningful opportunity to claim a fear of torture or persecution if sent to that third country. This is the latest blow to Trump's efforts to fast-track its deportations of millions of immigrants. Federal courts across the country have ruled against him in some of his major immigration-related policies. Sergio Martinez Beltran, NPR News.
President Trump and new Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney had their first call today, and as Dan Karpinchuk reports, both say they had a constructive conversation on the issue of tariffs.
Carney says he and Trump agreed that comprehensive negotiations about a new economic and security relationship would begin immediately after the Canadian election on April 28. But Carney says Canada will implement retaliatory tariffs in response to Trump's auto tariffs announced this week. Trump said he would follow through with more tariffs if there is any Canadian retaliation. Trump referred to Carney as Prime Minister, not as governor, as he did with his predecessor Justin Trudeau, and did not refer to Canada as the 51st state. For NPR News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
Stocks sharply lower on Wall Street by the bell today on inflation and tariff worries. The Dow down 715, the Nasdaq down 481, the S&P 500 down 112. For the Nasdaq, that's down 2.7%. You're listening to NPR News. In Texas, health officials say the state has now confirmed 400 measles cases since the outbreak began there in January. NPR's Maria Godoy reports that's a jump of 77 new cases just since Tuesday.
The number of new cases reported this week shows just how contagious the measles virus is. Texas health officials say they are expecting more cases. So far, 41 people have been hospitalized with measles in the state. Four other states are also reporting measles outbreaks. New Mexico has 44 cases, Kansas has 23, Oklahoma has 7 confirmed cases with another 2 suspected, and Ohio this week reported an outbreak of measles with 10 cases. The vast majority of cases are in people who were not vaccinated. So far this year, the U.S. has reported more than 480 measles cases in 20 states. That's more cases than in all of 2024. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
Utah is now the first state in the country to ban fluoride in public drinking water. The law goes into effect in early May and comes amid new scrutiny of the additive, a mineral to help prevent cavities that's been in many drinking water systems around the U.S. since 1945. This after Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. said he would advise all U.S. water systems to remove fluoride because of what he says are potential health risks, though scientists disagree. They argue that any adverse effects of fluoride are associated only with exposure at much higher levels, and fluoride is proven to reduce the number of cavities people experience. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. Americans are in a funk about the economy, and it's beginning to affect how they spend their money. Personal spending in February was weaker than expected, and that points to a slowdown in economic growth. Surveys suggest that many people are nervous about President Trump's trade policies, and investors are nervous too. The Dow Jones Industrial Average tumbled more than 700 points today. NPR Scott Horsley is here with the latest. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Juana.
Scott, I understand that we got some new economic numbers this morning. What did they tell us?
They tell us that people are worried. The latest survey from the University of Michigan shows consumer sentiment fell for the third month in a row. People across the political spectrum are worried about inflation. They're worried about the job market. Some of that is being driven by President Trump's policies on tariffs and government job cuts. Dan Fitch is a nurse who works for the Veterans Administration in Portland, Oregon. He feels like his own job's pretty secure, but he worries about his colleagues and says the overall outlook is not great.
I don't see things going in a positive direction. I really don't. The cost of living has already been elevated for a while. Start adding on tariffs. I don't see how that positively affects anybody.
Fitch says he and his family have been cutting back on spending. They're not traveling as much as they usually do. He's even stopped paying for haircuts for his 3- and 7-year-old sons.
Yeah, I bought a pair of clippers, and I'm cutting both my kids' hair now. Heck, I might start doing my own, too. I did for a number of years when I was in college. It might be time to try again. It can get pretty ugly, but it's worth it for a little bit more peace of mind where your money's concerned.
And Fitch is not the only one taking clippers to his family's budget. Today, the Commerce Department said spending on services like haircuts rose by a meager 0.2% last month, and spending at restaurants was actually down.
I mean, I'm not an expert, but this does not sound great for the economy.
It's not. Consumer spending is the biggest driver of the U.S. economy, and it has been remarkably resilient in recent years. But senior economist Dan North of Allianz Trade North America says that consumer engine may be sputtering a bit.
I think if you're a consumer, you're sitting there and saying, I'm not so sure about these tariffs here. My income's kind of dwindling a little bit. Oh, and by the way, I just opened up my credit card bill, and there's still items I need to pay off from Christmas. I'm going to draw my horns in a little bit.
Now, while services spending was weak last month, we did see a burst of spending on big ticket items. Some of that may have been defensive spending as shoppers tried to get ahead of the president's tariffs.
Yeah, and when you talk about big ticket items, that makes me think of cars and the 25% tariff that Trump announced a few days ago. That goes into effect next week, right?
That's right. And Trump has also telegraphed other far-reaching tariffs next week. Look, tariffs or taxes, and economists say that is going to push prices higher. I spoke to a man this morning who timed his own new car purchase a couple of weeks ago deliberately to beat the president's tariffs. He also discovered that his favorite oatmeal comes from Canada, so to avoid import taxes on that, he stockpiled enough to keep his cereal bowl full for the next 8 months or so. Likewise, Dawn Woodward, who lives in Michigan, recently bought her son a new TV weeks before his birthday because she was worried about tariffs. When it comes to other shopping, though, Woodward's been trying to cut back.
And I found that stuff that I thought I needed. Oh, my gosh, I need this or I need that. I didn't really actually need most of it.
Instead of buying stuff, Woodward says she's putting more money aside urgency. And she's not alone. No. That people stocked away in savings last month rose to its highest level in 8 months.
NPR's Scott Horsley, thanks.
You're welcome.
Some commercial fishermen are facing stricter regulations because of President Trump's cuts at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric. From our member station, The Publix Radio, Ben Burke takes us to the docks of America's highest grossing fishing port, where scallop boats will be hauling in a lighter catch next month.
The sea scallop is the most valuable catchable coast. And this year, the federal government is late reviewing new regulations. That means scallop boats in New Bedford, Massachusetts, will see their catch limits cut by 25% until the new regulations get approved.
So it's a little bit of climbing. You've got to get down here. But
Eric Hansen owns two scallop boats. On the deck of the Intrepid, he tells me there's a lot of talk on the waterfront about President Trump slashing jobs at NOAA. But Hansen says most fishermen don't realize how this will affect them yet.
Some are welcoming the cuts, saying that the government has been their downfall. There's too many regulations, and I don't share that opinion.
That's because Hansen remembers when the scallop fishery hit rock bottom.
I fished when there was very little regulation, and the fishery was almost at a state of collapse. We didn't catch the last scallop, but we were trying to.
In the 90s, fishermen collaborated with NOAA on regulations that saved the fishery. Many boat owners like Hansen now volunteer their vessels to collect data that NOAA uses to keep a close eye on scallop populations. Hansen also serves on the New England Fishery Management Council, which uses that data to set sustainable catch limits.
Given the long history that I have with my family in the industry, I wanted to make sure that there was a future for my son and my grandson. And the only way to get good stewardship is if you have good information.
In the most lucrative fisheries, NOAA leads multiple surveys a year where scientists board ships, go fishing, and draw statistical inferences from what comes up in their nets and dredges. But some of these scientists, like fish biologist Sarah Weisberg, got emails telling them they were fired last month.
You know, my phone started lighting up and everyone around me started crying because other people were getting essentially the exact same email word for word sent to, now we know, hundreds of people. Closer to 1,000 people.
Weisberg was about to go out on a survey to collect data on groundfish like cod and haddock. She says NOAA almost had to cancel the survey because there weren't enough scientists. They ended up scrambling together a crew, but Weisberg says if NOAA cancels future surveys, it will damage one of the agency's mission-critical services.
It's how we know anything really meaningful about what's happening out at sea.
Weisberg and other scientists may win their jobs back through a federal lawsuit. But Janet Coit, who led NOAA Fisheries until January, says the Trump administration is still trying to cut an additional 1,000 jobs across the agency. She says this wouldn't actually loosen any fishing regulations.
There has been no law enacted that eliminates the need for regulations. They're still required. And so if you reduce the number of people that work on the regulations, you actually could gum up the works and have a counterproductive result.
A spokesperson for NOAA declined to comment, but scallop boat owner Eric Hansen says losing fisheries scientists will lead to blurrier estimates of fish populations. As a member of New England's Fishery Management Council, Hansen says he'll be required by law to act more cautiously and set stricter catch limits. As a fisherman, he expects his own crew to feel the impact next year.
Less resources for science would mean a smaller paycheck in the simplest terms.
The Intrepid only spent about 40 days at sea last year. Hansen expects to be fishing even less next year. For NPR News, I'm Ben Burke in New Bedford, Massachusetts.
B
big law is starting to fight back. Two major law firms sued the Trump administration today. They're asking a judge to block executive orders that punish those firms because of their clients and the lawyers that they hired. NPR Justice correspondent Carrie Johnson has been following these cases and joins us now to talk more about them. Hi, Carrie.
Hey there.
Okay, so let's just start with who sued today. Tell us.
These are two big law firms, Jenner and Block and WilmerHale. They filed cases today in the federal court right here in Washington, D.C. They say the Trump administration violated the Constitution when the president moved against them recently. The executive orders from the White House took some pretty drastic steps. The orders yanked security clearances from lawyers, barred them from entering government buildings.
Wow.
Both Jenner and Wilmer say they could suffer irreparable harm if those executive actions are allowed to stand. So they're asking a judge to block the orders.
Wait, what do we know about why these firms even caught the attention of President Trump?
Well, the White House has been on a campaign against law firms for a few weeks now.
Mm-hmm.
President Trump has accused them of helping to weaponize the justice system against his administration. Trump actually called out pro bono work the firms had done for immigrants and LGBTQ people. In the case of Jenner, he blasted a lawyer who helped investigate Trump and who remains a fierce critic of the president. Here's Trump at the signing ceremony with one of his aides this week.
And Andrew Weissman is the main culprit.
He's certainly
with respect to this firm.
He is one of a number of reasons that we believe this executive order is warranted.
He's a bad guy.
That lawyer, Andrew Weissman, has not worked at Jenner and Block for 4 years. And as for Wilmer, that law firm employed former special counsel Robert Mueller, who led the Russia investigation. It also employed two other lawyers who work for Mueller. Wilmer says it also represented the Democratic National Committee.
Okay, well, it's still early in the process, but are there any hints, Carrie, about how a judge might weigh some of these legal claims?
We have some evidence. Judge Beryl Howell here in D.C. recently sided with another law firm called Perkins Coie after it sued over a similar executive order from Trump. She said that action sent chills down her spine and threatened to undermine the legal system because it interfered with people's right to a lawyer. These new cases today have been assigned to different judges who have been on the bench since the George W. Bush administration. But this is not necessarily a partisan issue. In fact, the Wilmer law firm that sued today is being represented by Paul Clement, who was Solicitor General under President Bush. Clement said today, this case is absolutely critical to the adversarial system of justice and the rule of law.
I mean, Carrie, there has been a lot of attention on the broader legal industry these days and how it's responding to pressure from President Trump. What are you hearing on this front generally?
Well, the president has just announced a settlement with the huge Skadden law firm, where he said the firm agreed to do about $100 million of pro bono work for causes the administration supports. That marks the second such settlement after the law firm Paul Weiss reached a similar deal. Walter Olson's a senior fellow at the Libertarian Cato Institute. He's been following this with some concern.
It is so central to being able to be a good lawyer, to be at the top of your craft as a lawyer, to be fearless, and to be able to go up against the most powerful interests, of which the most powerful is the federal government. And if they can't do that, what can they do for their client?
That is NPR's Carrie Johnson. Thank you, Carrie.
Thanks.
It's NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Amazon Business, offering business buying tools and technology with the goal of simplifying how to stock up to get ahead. Learn more at amazonbusiness.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Measles is now spreading in 5 states: Texas, New Mexico, Kansas, Ohio, and Oklahoma. Most of the cases are in West Texas, which reported today that they have had 400 cases since the outbreak started. Measles spreads quickly in communities with low vaccination rates, and vaccine hesitancy has been on the rise for years. But now, some pediatricians are seeing vaccine enthusiasm. NPR's Maria Godoy is here to tell us more. Hi, Maria.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so what are the latest numbers we're seeing right now on measles?
Well, today, Texas reported 77 new cases just since Tuesday, which just goes to show how contagious measles is.
Health
officials there are expecting more cases. And as you noted, the virus is now spreading in other states. New Mexico has 44 cases, Kansas has 23. So there's concern that the virus will keep spreading.
And do most cases involve people who are not vaccinated?
Correct. The vast majority are not vaccinated. But here's something interesting. While we're hearing a lot about parents who don't want to vaccinate their kids, pediatricians I've been talking to are also hearing from worried parents who want their kids to get their vaccines early.
What do you mean by early?
So normally kids get their first measles vaccine between 12 and 15 months and then a second dose between 4 and 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
But the CDC says in certain situations you can get the measles vaccine as young as 6 months, like if you're traveling abroad or are in an outbreak area. I spoke with Dr. Shannon Fox-Levine. She's a pediatrician in Broward County, Florida.
Our call center was inundated with calls about, you know, MMR vaccine. Is their child up to date? Should they get another vaccine? Should they get an extra one? Can they get it early?
And this is in Florida, where vaccine hesitancy has been growing. So Fox-Levine says hearing vaccine enthusiasm is exciting.
Why do you think there has been an uptick in enthusiasm?
Well, two things. Parents are watching what's happening with these outbreaks, and they're worried that measles will spread to where they live. You know, it is spring break season now, so people are traveling, and if you have kids who are too young for the vaccine, you might worry that you could run into someone with measles or that someone with measles could travel to your community.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the concerns pediatricians are hearing, but there's also politics at play.
What do you mean? Like, what kind of politics?
Well, several pediatricians told me they're hearing from parents who are worried about the future of vaccine access. These are parents who watch the news. They know that Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has been a longtime critic of vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
Here's Dr. Susan Sirota. She's a pediatrician in the Chicago area.
There's a bit of fear among moms and dads and parents about their ability to protect their children and to prevent diseases because vaccine access is in question for them.
And, you know, it's not just the measles vaccine. Sirota says some patients are worried about access to the HPV vaccine, which protects against cervical cancer. Kennedy has been involved in legal challenges to that vaccine. Now, during his confirmation hearing, Kennedy said he wouldn't take vaccines away from anyone. He's called them a personal choice. We did reach out to HHS for comment. They did not respond.
That is NPR's Maria Godoy. Thank you so much, Maria.
My pleasure.
The southern Indian city of Chennai has produced some of the world's most formidable chess players. Reporter Omkar Khandekar traveled there to learn more.
It's a standing ovation for a new chess prodigy. 26-year-old Arvind Chidambaram crowned as the winner at Chennai Grandmasters tournament last year. Fans rushed to the door to catch him. They want selfies and autographs. The tournament organizers form a human chain so players can leave without being mobbed. Chess isn't just popular in India. Many here are good at it. 6 Indians rank among the world's top 25. And at the World Chess Championship last December,
takes a bishop d5, and Gukesh will be the world champion.
Indian national Gukesh Domaraju became the youngest ever world champion at age 18. This is a remarkable shift for the chess world. After decades of Russian and European dominance, the spotlight is on India. And within India, one city is chess ground zero, Chennai, hometown of two world champions, and a place that chess trainer V. Sarvanan calls the factory of Indian chess.
Chess in Chennai is grown by a proper system of teaching from the grassroots.
Sarvanan says people in Chennai take chess very seriously. Some schools grant promising players holidays to train and travel. Local businesses pay their expenses. But perhaps the city's greatest asset is parents. Typically, Indian parents don't encourage their kids to pursue sports professionally. Chess is different. Sarvanan again.
In India, we have this basic belief among parents that our way to happiness and prosperity is through academics. Chess, in some respects, resembles academics.
So in recent years, chess clubs have mushroomed across the city.
Have you finished the homework?
One of those chess clubs is run by Vishnu Prasanna. He says the success of some students, like the current world champion Gokesh Dhammaraju, has turbocharged enrollments.
We had a 3.5-year-old kid who was walking in yesterday to train with us, and parents are also viewing it, right? So they would love if the kid is playing chess.
Some of them really want their kids to play chess. One father, Suresh Dasharathan, shared his 6-year-old son's daily routine. Wake up at 7, an hour of chess practice, then school, then an hour of chess coaching at the club, then homework, and bedtime at 9 p.m. Dasharathan says he wants his son to make it international.
If he is good in chess, definitely I will bring him to the next level and take him to the international podium. That is my dream.
His dream. But it's down to the kids to make their parents' dreams come true. On the day of Chennai Grandmasters Tournament, we met Ravina, a 6-year-old chess student whose mother asked that we only use her first name because of her age.
They will force the kids to win and they will tell, I will give you dinner only if you win this game. And then some kids will just cry if they don't win.
It's a striking contrast to just a few decades ago when India's first chess champion was growing up in Chennai. Vishwanathan Anand is a 5-time world champion who even bested Russian legend Garry Kasparov. He says in the 80s, chess in India was seen as a hobby.
In those days, the question was all sports were nice hobbies to have, and then the parents quickly guided you back to your studies the closer you got to the end of school because you need a real job.
He says parents are taking chess more seriously now because it is something you can make a living from. The Indian government often gives champion players a job in the public sector. High-ranking players can win prize money in a newly launched global chess league. Many also work as chess coaches. Player and coach Srinath Narayanan says that's why Indian parents drive their kids so hard.
There is a massive supply of people and very limited opportunities. And something like sport is also seen as a way to jump that queue.
And even if players don't make it to the top,
even if you don't end up making it big in chess, it is still helpful for you in whatever your primary career is.
Their primary career, which more often than not is by going through the grind of academics. Omkar Khandekar, NPR News, Chennai.
This is NPR News.
In 2015, a million migrants clambered onto small boats and tried to make it to Greece. Many didn't make it.
We saw this terrible sight of hundreds of orange and blue life jackets out in these roiling seas.
In her new book, Jean Carstensen tracked down survivors to hear their stories. Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Juana Summers. Coming up, the new movie, The Ballad of Wallace Island.
It's based on a short film that's almost 20 years old.
We both have like a lot of love for the short film. So whenever we'd meet up with Griff, the director, we would always talk about it after a couple of pints.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. Public health advocates are pushing back against more than $11 billion in funding cuts announced this week by the Department of Health and Human Services. NPR's Ping Wong reports those funds supported thousands of public health departments across the country.
Dr. Phil Huang is director of Dallas County Health and Human Services in Texas. He says that in the midst of an ongoing measles outbreak, some of the funds were being used to help vaccinate school children.
And some of the staff that have been going out to do these measles vaccine campaigns are some of the staff that we're talking about are in these funding cuts.
HHS says they cut these grants because they were COVID grants and the COVID pandemic is over. State and local health officials say the grants were largely used to address problems uncovered by the pandemic, such as data modernization. These cuts, they say, will leave some of them using fax machines. Ping Huang, NPR News.
A longtime member of the House Intelligence Committee is calling for changes in the way the Trump administration shares sensitive military information. After this week's breach, in which a group of texts chat about an imminent military attack on Iran-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen, included the editor-in-chief of the Atlantic magazine. Congressman Mike Quigley of Illinois says it was not just this incident, but it's part of a larger picture that concerns him and threatens, as he puts it, national security.
What really concerned me is the fact that no one takes responsibility, right? This is a serious breach. This is a critical error. I would respect them a lot more, and I'd feel a lot better going forward if someone acknowledged that, if someone was held accountable, and they recognize that this can't happen again. There have to be significant changes.
Representative Quigley says he's in his ninth year on the Intelligence Committee and has grave concerns. Stocks finished broadly lower on Wall Street today. This is NPR. Wisconsin's Democratic Attorney General is asked a court to block Elon Musk from handing out million-dollar checks to voters this weekend ahead of the state's hotly contested Supreme Court election. Rich Kramer reports.
The Supreme Court race, with spending above $81 million, has shattered records for a U.S. judicial election. Elon Musk and two PACs he's associated with have poured $20 million into the contest, which some view as a referendum on President Trump's first few weeks in office. In a since-deleted social media post, Musk said he would travel to Wisconsin to hand out the million-dollar checks in appreciation for voting. Musk now says the money will go to people who have signed his petition opposing what he calls activist judges. Even with Musk's apparent change of reasoning, Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call is seeking a court order to stop the giveaway. For NPR News, I'm Rich Kramer in Eau Claire, Wisconsin.
A federal judge in Washington, D.C. has agreed to block the Trump administration from dismantling the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. That preliminary injunction today will maintain the agency's existence until the judge rules on the merits of the suit. President Trump suspended the agency's operations and fired 70 workers, including its director. The CFPB is responsible for protecting consumers from financial fraud as well as deceptive business practices. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station.
And from Bank of America, from local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. Australian researchers say they are concerned about the future of scientific collaboration with the United States after the sudden withdrawal of U.S. funding for some of the country's top universities. This comes as some Australian university researchers were sent surveys containing questions on diversity, U.S. gender policy, and China. Christina Kukolia reports.
Making headlines in Australia, this from Sky News.
The White House has cut funding to seven Australian universities after they were sent surveys to see if joint research projects aligned with Donald Trump's agenda.
Australia's government says some university researchers who collaborate with US institutions have had US government grants cancelled or suspended since January. Federal Education Minister Jason Clare told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation the government believes it's part of the US foreign aid review and is seeking more information.
And that's why the Australian Embassy is working with US officials to get a better understanding about this issue.
The Australian National University in Canberra is the only university to publicly address the funding cuts. It says one of its researchers, whose grant was cancelled, was told by the US department funding their project was no longer in line with departmental priorities. The US, Australia's biggest international research partner, contributed over $250 million to Australian universities last year. Australian Academy of Science Chief Executive Anna Maria Arabia says the loss of collaboration will also hurt the US.
So this is not a case of the US gifting money to Australia, where we benefit and there is no benefit to the United States. It is very much a reciprocal benefit between the two nations.
The US action has shocked the Australian university sector after some researchers, like their colleagues in Canada and the European Union, were sent a survey from their US partners or federal agencies, including USAID, the State and Agriculture Departments. NPR has sought responses from both the Departments of State and Agriculture, and the State Department says all US foreign assistance is currently undergoing a foreign assistance review following the executive order. The Agriculture Department has yet to reply. Anna Maria Arabia from the Australian Academy of Science.
So there are questions that relate to diversity, equity and inclusion, alignment with policies to do with the Mexican border, interaction with communist countries. So they are political in nature, around value systems. They're religious in some cases.
NPR understands that some Australian researchers were told the survey is linked to a January memo instructing federal agencies to review US financial assistance programs. The memo from the US Office of Management and Budget states financial assistance should be dedicated to advancing administration priorities and focusing taxpayer dollars to advance a stronger and safer America.
There's kind of no rhyme or reason as to how these questionnaires are going out. It's not particular disciplines, particular universities.
That's Vicky Thompson, who heads the Group of Eight, a body representing Australia's main research-intensive universities.
We don't really have a sense of the consequences of answering the questions.
Thompson fears vital scientific research could be at risk.
We're very worried that, you know, the canary in the coal mine is at the smaller end of projects, the 300,000 to maybe a couple of million in a range of areas. We would not want to see that as it relates to clinical medicine, biomedical and vaccine development.
For NPR News, Christina Kukolia in Melbourne, Australia.
Millions of Americans don't have high-speed internet, and connecting these people is big business. Among those who want a slice of that money is billionaire Elon Musk. NPR's Bobby Allen looked into how Musk's Starlink satellite network could soon have more power over how underserved parts of the country get online.
The idea got a huge boost on the Joe Rogan podcast. Trump sat down with Rogan just before the presidential election. They're discussing a federal grant program created to connect the more than 20 million Americans without at-home internet. construction has not begun.
They haven't hooked up one person
Not
yet.
One person. They spent $42 billion. That's could have gotten Starlinks to everybody with that kind of money.
For almost nothing.
Yeah.
For a monthly charge.
And it would have been incredible. And it's high-speed internet everywhere you want to go.
And he wanted to do that.
The Trump administration has now taken steps to allow Musk to do that. Congress created the Broadband Equity and Access Deployment Program in 2021. After years of planning, more than 30 states are ready to extend underground fiber cables to mostly rural households. The Commerce Department recently announced a review of the program. It emphasized a tech-neutral approach. In plain English, that means Musk's satellite service could get some of that business.
How much money can he get? How much money can he prevent a competitor from getting?
That's Blair Levin, a telecom policy expert at the Brookings Institution.
If the decision is made on the basis of politics, it will cost the country for decades to come.
Levin says right now, traditional fiber broadband is faster, cheaper, and generally more stable than satellite internet like Starlink, though he says it is very good for people with no other options. The person Trump tapped to make decisions over this big pool of money is Ariel Roth. She's been nominated to be a top official in the Commerce Department. She once said this $42 billion grant program had extreme tech bias in favor of fiber. Roth's Senate confirmation hearing was this week. Democrats push her to commit to not turning the broadband program into a subsidy for Musk.
If I'm fortunate to be confirmed, I will administer the program to the benefit of the American people, not any single individual or company.
During Roth's hearing, Ted Cruz, a Republican senator from Texas, said the billionaire did not get a fair shake when the program started.
The Biden administration, I think, engaged in petulant and partisan politics by blacklisting Elon Musk and Starlink, which is technology that could have connected particularly households in distant rural places.
With Musk now a top advisor in the White House, analysts like Drew Garner with the Benton Institute for Broadband and Society say if Starlink wins a big slice of the federal program,
then America's taxpayers' money are going to be going to pay Elon Musk to give Americans expensive and slow internet service when they could have had fast, affordable internet service.
Musk and the Commerce Department did not return requests for comment. There are other ways Starlink can benefit. The Federal Communications Commission is now headed by outspoken Musk supporter Brendan Carr. In 2023, the Biden FCC turned down Starlink for a nearly $900 million rural broadband contract. Carr disagreed with the decision, criticizing the move as a clear error that will cause even more delays. Under Carr, the FCC can revisit this decision. Garner, the broadband expert, says Starlink didn't get the money at the time because underground cables were viewed as cheaper and more reliable.
You do essentially have to rebuild the Starlink network every 5 years because satellites are constantly falling out of the sky.
And then there's radio spectrum, the invisible highways for all of our wireless communication. Starlink will be asking the FCC for more of it. If it prevails, Starlink could get a big edge over other satellite companies. NPR reached out to five Starlink rivals. None would agree to an interview. Levin with Brookings says this is because of a culture of fear.
I think everybody is reluctant to attack Musk or to attack the president.
Levin says companies worry about retaliation from the White House, which this month began to receive Starlink internet service. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. For decades, the World Trade Organization refereed global trade disputes until it was sidelined by the U.S. So, in the midst of a new trade war, Waylon Wong and Adrian Ma of The Indicator from Planet Money explain why Washington has turned its back on an organization it helped create.
After World War II, powerful countries like the U.S. and the United Kingdom got together to set up the new ground rules for the global economy.
These post-war arrangements culminated in the creation of the World Trade Organization in 1995. It's basically a big club of countries that agree to trade with each other using the same set of rules.
When governments get into disputes over these rules, they go to the WTO, and here's how that process works. First, the case gets heard by a panel of experts. They make a ruling.
And then the governments can appeal that decision to a different panel of experts. This group is known as the appellate body.
Jennifer Hillman is a professor at the Georgetown Law Center, and she served on the appellate body from 2007 to early 2012.
You basically have to be ready to drop everything the minute you are put onto an appeal, fly to Geneva, and then the work is quite intense.
Intense, like 70 to 80 hour weeks. The panel has around just a couple of months to make a decision. And this ruling, by the way, is final.
And if at the end of the day, the appellate body says there was a violation, then what it does is recommend that the country bring its measure into compliance. In other words, fix the problem.
Fixing the problem might mean reducing tariffs on specific products or lifting a ban on certain kinds of imports. And for a while, the system of settling disputes worked. Jennifer says countries would generally follow the WTO rulings, even the U.S.
And the U.S. did lose at the WTO. Like several years ago, the state of Washington had to end a preferential tax rate for aerospace manufacturing. This came out of a long-running dispute between the U.S. and the EU over subsidies to companies like Boeing and Airbus.
Quinn Slobodian is a professor of international history at Boston University. He points out that when it helped found the WTO, the U.S. signed onto a system where it wouldn't always get its way.
It was a moment where America, the world's most powerful country, saw it somehow in its own interests to cede part of their sovereignty to this international institution.
However, the U.S. would eventually grow unhappy with the WTO. Quinn says a big factor here is China, which joined the group in 2001 and became an economic powerhouse. And yeah, China was part of the same economic club, but it was also claiming exemptions from free trade rules on the basis of it being a developing country. Jennifer says these frustrations came to a head during the Obama administration. And so the U.S. blocked the reappointment of some members to the WTO appeals panel. Then, during the first Trump administration, the U.S. started blocking all new appointments to the appellate body. In late 2019, the group stopped functioning because it didn't have enough members.
This paralysis continued through the Biden administration, although it had been in talks on reforming the WTO appeals panel. That work didn't get done before Biden left office.
Where does this leave other countries? Well, historian Quinn Slobodian says governments have been busy making trade deals without the U.S. In fact, Quinn says he thinks the future of international cooperation looks more like this, a bunch of regional agreements.
Weilin Wang,
Adrian Ma, NPR News.
All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. In 2007, a short film explored a classic question. What would you do if you won the lottery? In this story, the answer was, invite your favorite musician to play a gig on your remote British island.
This doesn't make sense. Where will people be? You said there'd be 100.
No, Herb.
Well, yes, you did.
No, I said there'd be less than 100.
How many less than 100?
Huh?
How many less than 100?
99.
The comedians Tim Key and Tom Basden wrote and starred in that short film, and they just couldn't get the characters out of their heads. Here's Tim.
It's been on our radar ever since. We both have like a lot of love for the film and a lot of love for making the film, the short film. So whenever we'd meet up with Griff, the director, we would always talk about it after a couple of pints.
So nearly 20 years later, they've revisited the characters and the premise in the new full-length feature, The Ballad of Wallace Island. Their friend James Griffiths directed both. Tom plays Herb, the cranky, too cool musician, and Tim plays Charles, the goofy but lovable lottery winner.
What do you do? You're a banker? Or oil? It's oil, isn't it?
I'm retired.
Because I'm not playing a private gig for some oil tycoon or whatever.
Where's oil come from?
I'm anti-corporate, famously.
I'm anti-corporate. Believe me, I hate bloody, I can't think of one, but...
Because, you know...
IKEA, bad example.
They both joined me to talk about the long journey since the short and the film that ultimately came out of it.
This is Tom. I think, you know, it's funny because we were far too young. When we made the short, we were far too young for those characters. It didn't really make sense, actually. And now, having you know, rightly or wrongly waited 19 years, we're the perfect age to play these sort of slightly careworn characters who've been kind of, you know, spat out by life in various different ways. There's something that's really kind of lovely about the fact it's taken this long.
We have had a lot of interviews where afterwards we're worried we've given the impression that we've spent 18 years clocking in at our office every 5 days a week trying to work out how to make this feature.
Uh-huh.
We've definitely done stuff in the meantime.
The story is largely built around three characters, and there is no way for me to ask this without sounding rude, but the third character is played by Carey Mulligan, who is far more famous than either of you. So how did she get involved?
You could have had more of a stab at making it less rude. Yeah, no, it is crazy that Carey Mulligan's in our film. It's one of those things when you're writing something like a feature, which you don't know if it will ever be filmed. It's much easier, rather than just carry on writing and polishing it, you just make a wish list of who should play her. And Carey was on top of our list.
Do you have anything of mine?
Yeah.
What is it? Is it creepy?
It's hair, yeah.
Hair?
It's a lock of your hair, yes.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
Whose hair are they selling you?
Your hair. Is it? No? Is it not yours?
No.
Ah.
Nope. I've been scammed there, Charlie. I've never auctioned off any of my hair.
Miss old hair.
Yeah, I can hack some off before I go if you want.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you.
Amazingly, we asked her to do it, and it was just a potluck as to whether she knew who we were, and she did. But we were very, very fortunate that we were sort of pushing on an open door, as in she was aware of what we do and was very, very kind about the script.
Yeah. I genuinely did love the music that you wrote for this film, Tom.
Oh, thanks, Ari.
If you need some affection and you're feeling alone.
And I'm curious whether you were trying to write it in the style of the character who you were playing, or if it is the kind of music that you authentically write when you sit down to write a song as yourself.
I mean, it's the closest I will get to releasing an album as a musician, because they're sort of songs that I kind of believe in musically.
You don't think this is going to launch a solo touring career for you?
I mean, that's the aim, obviously. It's, I can't be bothered with this acting nonsense, but like, for now anyway, I'm happy to kind of, you know, play the character of a musician as a kind of like, you know, workaround. But yeah, the music is certainly, I guess I tried to write what I felt like made sense for the characters, but I also, you know, I guess I wanted the music to sound and feel like the kind of music that Charles' character would have really loved, and therefore be the kind of music that I might listen to.
Sink into each other's eyes, stay inside, as though the sun will never rise. Oh, give me your love to me. Honey, give me your love to me.
Although the film is very funny, it has a lot of heart. Can you tell me about, as you were writing it, how you balanced that sort of overt comedy and the relationships that bolster the narrative?
We knew that we wanted the film to go somewhere beyond being just a collection of sort of comic moments or kind of like funny but difficult interactions between these two guys, and then when Gary turns up in her character as well. And I think that we quickly found, this is when we're writing the script, by the way, and there's something about getting older and your relationship to music that means that your relationships with people and your relationship with music is very, very closely linked. And actually, it sort of allows you to tap into emotional periods of your life instantly. And I still feel that when I listen to certain music, and I think a lot of people do.
Sometimes when you smile, I can see how you would have looked as a child.
So I think there's something specific about this story that we quickly realized was a real opportunity to find a sort of emotional backstory and language for the characters that's often very difficult to achieve in a comedy.
I think that's why both of us are quite proud of it, because you finish writing it and that's what you've tried to do, is make it have some kind of heart and depth, and you think maybe you've got a chance when you start filming it, then you don't know until you put it in front of an audience. So actually when it first played out in Sundance, it was completely Tom will tell you, I was a mess. It's a very overwhelming experience.
Tim was in pieces.
Yeah, I was in pieces.
To see that an audience responded and it hit them the way you wanted it to.
Exactly. It was kind of amazing. And I think we're really proud of that, because I think it's quite easy to mess up. And actually, we might try and make another film and not be able to get that perfectly. And in this one, I do think like we're both like really happy that we've at least come some way to getting that, both of the humor and the warmth in the mix somewhere.
You open my eyes, help me remember.
Well, gentlemen, it has been so good talking with you. Thank you very much.
Lovely
You're
to talk
welcome.
To you.
Thanks for watching the film.
Tom Basden and Tim Key wrote and star in The Ballad of Wallace Island, which is out in theaters now.
I'm tired of lying to myself. I needed a friend to throw me a lifeline. Remember to lend, not to keep taking all the time.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens selected for home landscapes. More at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options, at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from the John D.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.
Ain't no hope.
Crooked nose. He lived down in the log hut and we called him Old Man Moe. One dark and dreary morning I knocked upon his door. Well, I didn't hear a single sound and I ain't gonna do it no more, 'cause I believe,
Old Man,
yes, I believe,
Old Man,
I do believe,
Old Man,
that Old Man Moe's is dead. Whoa, I believe,
Old Man,
I sure believe,
Old Man,
yes, I believe,
Old Man,
that Old Man Moe's is dead.
We believe.
He kicked the bucket.